Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy. Thanks so much for listening. Remember that you can always email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com, and you can also find us on Facebook. This evening, our guest is Liz Markey, and just a moment, she's going to be back and tell you all about what she's up to. This is Heartstock, and I'm Carol Murphy. Thanks for listening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Today, our guest is Liz Markey. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Carol, and thank you so much for having me as your guest today.
Oh, thank you for being our guest. Please tell our listeners just a brief intro here about what you do. You're the director at Youth Entrepreneurs in Polson, Montana, is that right?
I am. This is a relatively new, what I would call encore endeavor in my life. Most people in Montana know me formally as the CEO and president of Montana West Economic Development, and then for the last 13 years as the founder and coordinator for Frontier Angels, which I recently passed off leadership to someone who's very wonderful, Pat LaPointe in Bozeman. So that's what I'm up to these days.
And Youth Entrepreneurs, I'm assuming, maybe incorrectly, that it is pretty much what it sounds like. You work with high schoolers in Polson?
So actually, Carol, when I decided, and I have loved my work as an angel investor and being an active angel, but it became a point in time where someone who was a little bit closer to the technology world and closer to having exited a technology company really had a better, what I would call, window on understanding, you know, the applications of all the amazing technologies we're seeing come down the pike today, like blockchain and Bitcoin and artificial intelligence. But I have always been part and parcel of the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And one of the big gaps in Montana, and actually in this country, is the introduction of entrepreneurial thinking in younger people. I don't know about you, but I don't think I heard the word entrepreneur until I was in my 20s or 30s. I certainly hadn't heard the word angel investor or a lot of ideation thinking or a lot of the other terms that go with new business creation until much later in life. And so I have always been a very strong collaborator, and I sort of decided to do some due diligence and look at some of the offerings across the country that were working in this area of youth entrepreneurship. And I came upon this program. It's youthentrepreneurs.org. It's a 22-year-old program, but it had been relatively focused on how it deployed its program. They were mostly working in urban areas. And I convinced them that they were missing the boat, that I thought rural America was an ideal place to beta this kind of curriculum. And tell me if I'm getting too long-winded here, but I looked at a number of pedagogies. What I loved about the Youth Entrepreneurship Program is it's gamified and it's do first, talk later, so that it's very experiential learning, and it's based around seven foundational values of self-responsibility, being principled, knowledge, freedom, passion, opportunity, sound judgment, and a win-win focus. I love capitalism and markets, but they need to be understood from a very early age from a principled framework. And the youth entrepreneurship curriculum and pedagogy does that by taking those overarching principles and then teaching the tactical parts of business development, ideation thinking, risk assessment, collaboration, marketing, if you will, all the financial, you know, parts of that. And it, you know, at the end of the day, to me, what makes me such a passionate entrepreneur is it's solving problems, whether they're social problems or business problems. But that is a technique and a way of approaching problems that we don't introduce, I think, early enough. So I'm very passionate about it. It is a national program. We are the first rural state to be selected to deploy this. And one of the beautiful things about it is it's a completely public-private partnership. It's privately funded, but is deployed through our schools in the career and technical education classrooms.
So let's talk a little bit about yourself. just so that our listeners get to know you a little bit, Liz, a little earlier you said you were working on your Southern accent. Where in the South are you? Where in the South are you from?
Well, I had the great fortune of growing up in a very wonderful small college town called Auburn, Alabama. My father was a mechanical engineering professor, entrepreneur. He did research during the Saturn and Apollo years, and I grew up sort of in a mechanical engineering lab where people were building and inventing things like antennas to transmit video from space, which my dad did. So I was very lucky to grow up in a community where everyone was educated, where everyone was sort of one socioeconomic class. And in a way, there's some good parts of that and some bad parts of that. But I feel very fortunate to have had that kind of upbringing. And then to have the opportunity, I chose to go to a women's college, which only about 4% of people do. I'm a pretty big believer that you can't be what you can't see. And I was very drawn to the women that I saw attending women's colleges. They were, you know, growing companies, they were flying airplanes, they were doing things that weren't always the traditional path. And I'm quite a bit older than you. So I am one of those, you know, 70s sort of feminist women. And I still think we have an awful long way to go.
So you mentioned there were good, both good things and bad things about how and where you grew up.
Yeah.
I'm very curious, what were those good and bad things?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how may have they influenced you to become involved in entrepreneurship and business here in Montana?
So I think sort of the good certainly outweighed the bad. But as I've journeyed through life now and I'm in my Medicare year, I think a lot of my parents' motivation and a lot of people's motivation for creating and comes from necessity, sort of the mother of invention. And if you grow up with a comfortable life and very well-educated people, you do get, I have a wonderful sense of optimism in what's possible because I've seen great things created. But you also have to look around. I do a lot of reading. So many great people have done amazing things because it was out of necessity. And they really had no fear because they had nothing to lose. So I think there's kind of sort of a dual side for that. And I say that because as an investor and having looked at, you know, literally thousands of businesses, you sort of get a list of things that you want your entrepreneur to have experienced. And almost always we've invested in people who have failed because it's not about being perfect. It's about being resilient. And you don't know that you're resilient until you're tested. So it's one of the things I love about Montana, one of the reasons that I was drawn to come here. I think that people who grow up here are very resilient. They're resilient with our short winters, there, particularly ranch life. I married someone. We've lived on a ranch now almost 20 years. You know, you just learn how to solve problems to survive. So, yeah, I think that's one of our advantages in Montana. I think if we can move from survival to success, we have a lot of native talents and skills that you can bring to that journey of being an entrepreneur. As you know, Carol, you're an entrepreneur. It is not easy.
No, it definitely is not. And I have definitely failed. And I agree with what you're saying, that when you weather that storm and you don't give up, I mean, the absolute worst thing to do is to give up. And if you don't, when you get on the other side, you do realize, hey, I'm a lot tougher than I thought.
Absolutely. And part of that too, you know, I spoke last Friday at MSU, and the title of my talk was Wanting What You Get and Getting What You Want. And I think if you don't try things and fail, you don't sometimes really have a sense of what it's going to take to get what you think you want. And not everybody's willing to make that investment of time and money and energy. It's pretty exhausting to always be in an entrepreneurial phase. And I've been an entrepreneur since I was a kid. I didn't know that, but I always wanted to start things. My life motto is, in the difference between what is and can be, therein lies the challenge. And most people just like the status quo. Entrepreneurs are not status quo people. You are always looking for the bigger, better, cheaper, faster. And it's exhausting. And you need to know that. And you need to be able to get up every day and go after it again. But I love entrepreneurs because they create so much. They solve so many problems. We would never be the country we are without entrepreneurs, without risk takers, without people who are always looking to change the status quo. And we're solving so many problems, you know, cancer. I look at what's going on in medicine and technology. And, you know, people who are satisfied don't have that art to keep moving and looking for the better way.
You mentioned that you've been an entrepreneur since you were a child, and you didn't always realize that. What were some of your business endeavors early on?
Well, I started a newspaper in the fifth grade. I wasn't so much, and you know, I always had to sell the most brownie cookies, and I was always very competitive. And in my growing up, we actually didn't have sports for girls, so I had to find other ways to compete. And you know, girls aren't necessarily always encouraged to compete. And, you know, the South is wonderful, but a little bit different culture at times. And I always liked winning, not so much beating somebody else, but I always liked doing things people told me I couldn't do, like start an angel fund in Montana. Lots of people told me I couldn't do that, and I did it twice, and then I passed it off to somebody, and I know my space. I'm a startup girl. I like that concept, ideation, doing the hard thing. I have friends and I who discuss the fact that, you know, are we on the cutting edge or are we on the bleeding edge? Because that's kind of where I like to be, but I know where my space is. I don't like it when the HR people get hired. I don't like the rules. Those are absolutely necessary to scale. You need ops people who like to come in and do systems. I like to try. I love that experimental, what works, who's the customer, how is it going to work? So selling cookies, I didn't do anything particularly. I was pressed in my student body. I was always a leader, but you know, nobody said, why don't you apply your creativity and your innovation to something and then make money doing it? I was always raising money. So that's what I wound up doing, is raising money. I'm an entrepreneur at money raising in Montana, at private money, which I love because private money is very smart.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and in just a minute, maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the statistics related to women and venture capital, because you do realize how rare you are, right?
Well, I just think I'm early. I think the world is changing.
Okay. I agree. Okay. We're going to take a quick music break in just a moment. We will be right back with Liz Markey. This is Heart Stop. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy, your host. Thank you so much for listening. Our guest today is Liz Markey, and we were just talking about women raising money in the entrepreneur world. And there is a lovely statistic these days that I keep hearing repeated over and over again, that is kind of marching orders for women, female entrepreneurs these days. It's a statistic that says somewhere between 2-4% of the venture capital out there in the United States goes to female founders. So this being your niche, what do you think about that, Liz?
I think we've got a lot of opportunity for change. I went to work for a bank in 1978 when prime rate was 19.5%. And I was a terrible banker because, you know, everything a bank does in the analytical sense is in the past. And this was a really challenging time in the economy. And what really fascinated me were the companies that could do what we now call a pivot, who could really, you know, reimagine a marketplace, find new customers. And I had actually, not until I worked for a bank did I understand what an investment banker was, and then down the food chain to venture capital. So the first 25 venture capitalists I ever met were blonde, navy jackets, white, you know, button-down shirts, no socks and loafers. And it was a very, very unwelcoming culture. And money rooms, because you're the only woman in the money room. And money is power. And so to me, the next 50 years for women are about she who has the gold rules. So we have tended in the past culturally, and not everybody wants to be on the top 10 Forbes list, but I will tell you, I did a little research last week, and if you Google top 10 wealthiest women in America, 10 out of 10 inherited their money, and only one out of that 10 even works in the business in which they inherited their money. And that's the granddaughter of the Fidelity Financial manager. If you Google 10 wealthiest men in America, you don't get anything. It's actually the 10 wealthiest people, which happen to be men. 9 of the 10 of them are technology founders. One is an inheritor. It's a Walton from the Walton family, but they do work in the company. And I'm not talking about everybody doesn't aspire to quote unquote wealth, but the numbers are not right in the money world. And there's nothing statistically. We know that women are brilliant. We know they're now have reached parity in medical school, veterinary school. My daughter's a veterinarian. More than half the people are veterinarians now. Wall Street, it's a culture problem. And it's not so much, we keep talking about that word equality. I'm going to talk about culture. There's a long way to go where we are matched well. And my theory is we just need a lot more women investors. And I'm so thrilled to see that happening. I'm seeing lots of different cultures being established through groups like Portfolia. There are a number of women's only firms. I love Elevest, who are really focusing on women, money, investing, capital, because, you know, money's just an enabler, but it's a pretty important one. And business, good ideas, need to make money to sustain. And we all need to understand that you need to get what you're willing to put into it, be a little lucky. But money rooms have been male rooms, and they still are to a large extent. But my theory is we're making more progress putting the women together as a team than we are in trying to change the old culture. We're all still living in a world of work made for men by men. It's changing, but it's still not there.
In the work that you're doing with youth entrepreneurs, is there more gender equity on that level with the youngsters?
So that's an interesting question. So last Sunday morning, I got up at 6 o'clock and drove to the Flathead to judge codegirls.org. What we're seeing is when we give fourth, fifth, and sixth grade girls an opportunity to be together, they're building robots, they're building apps. It's those wonderful years of puberty where we have some issues, and then we start getting into different cultures. So it's really about letting people do what they love and what they're good at. So I wouldn't call it equity. I think that expectations, I mean, I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, I have four daughters. I have a veterinarian daughter. I have a daughter who's in the tech world doing great things. And I have a daughter who's a banker who has a young child, and she's a fabulous mother. I just think it's about giving a level playing field to being what you're good at and building a culture that is more principled and it's more about win-win than just about getting the number at any cost. I think it's one of the reasons that capitalism is criticized so much. And I really challenge anybody to go back and look at the last 20 years of corporate whistleblowers. The preponderance of them are women.
That's an interesting point. I love that you know that, by the way. So one of the topics that came up, I did this little event in New York City with Eileen Fisher, the group that I was...
Don't diminish that. It was a big event, and congratulations. I love Eileen Fisher.
It was a lot of fun. But my working group was shifting capital. And one of the subjects that came up was women own this space of philanthropy, and there's a huge pot of money there. Mm-hmm. And one of the ideas that came up was shifting that money, because it's not a shortage of money, it's a distribution issue.
Right.
So
right.
What do you think about this idea of shifting capital from philanthropy to the world of B Corps and social entrepreneurship? Because there's a lot of parallels there.
Absolutely. And it's actually one of the reasons I'm in the youth entrepreneurship world. That is a philanthropy-driven enterprise. There are trillions of dollars sitting around in philanthropy. And so this is the, having been a banker and then an angel investor, there's this vast chasm in the middle of capital appropriateness that we haven't defined or built systems for. When you're an angel investor, you need to get a 20 or 30x return on one or two investments because you're going to lose half of them. A banker wants cash flow and collateral. Entrepreneurs have neither. So there's this big middle ground that I think what you're talking about addresses very appropriately. What we have to be careful about, though, is that just because we want to do good we also have to do well, but we have to know what that is. Is that just getting your money back? Is that evergreen fund? Is that getting a 5% return, a 1% return, a 2x return? I think there is infinite financial technology opportunities, but there's a ton of education and experience that we yet need to discover about. It's the old risk reward curve. But we have to remember that doing good, there has to be some do well for some return, and people have to understand what that is. We're just not, and I love the democratizing of understanding capital. When I went to work for a bank, and I went to college to be a math major, left as a poli sci art history major, but I sort of had innate numerical skills. So they put me through their program and I was a credit analyst. And just being in the room, again, you can't be what you can't see, where loans are negotiated, where structures and deals are made. You got to be in those rooms. And it's one of the reasons I love angel investors. They invest their own money. And the angel community has really come together to standardize documents, to, be much more open and inclusive. This is not about holding knowledge. So I think there's just an enormous opportunity in new financing deployments, if you will. And you are absolutely right. There are trillions of dollars sitting in philanthropic organizations, but we also have to remember they were put there under a certain tax code.
Right.
And that's so there are going to have to be some very serious conversations about that. One of the things that's really concerned me though.
Liz, yes. I'm really sorry, but we've come to that. And we are running out of time. But I love the conversation and we can definitely have you back. How might guests find you?
Please feel free to email me at liz@lizmarkey.com.
Thank you so much for being on Heartstock, and we will definitely get you back and carry on this conversation. This is Carol Murphy. I'm your host of Heartstock, and Clark is in the studio. Thank you so much, Clark Grant. We'll see you next week. Peace.
And on the
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.